Welcome to the Golden Room. A podcast of the spoken word and acoustic delights. Celebrating storytelling, poetry, song, music, and creative fellowship. Pull up a chair and make yourself at home. Forget the world for a while and bathe in the light of the Golden Room.
I bid you all, good gentlefolk, to hark and listen well to those who stand before you here, their stories for to tell. Eat cake, drink tea, and settle while these wordsmiths here regale you with stories of such wonderment in song and verse and tale.
A seed is sown with a smile, in a hand offered in fellowship. The eyes can fertilize with a curious glance, a knowing look, and a single word the bud of love compels. A friendship can grow in the stoniest of soil, tested by cruel frosts and the bite of wind, blessed by the bounty of rain, by the kiss of the sun. Fair weather or foul, it flourishes. In every cycle of the day, the moon's tide, the year's wheel, friendship's crop is strengthened by those four chancy siblings, the seasons, it is forged. By icy time itself, it is tempered, and iron stalks the golden grains transmute. Then, when it is ripened, what riches it shall produce. The sacred bread of trust, the holy wine of tears, the sweet mead of laughter, of secrets shared and truths revealed, and all shall share in this feast. The goodness is gathered in by all, the tithe of effort for the tribe, who fill their grain store with it, their barns brim with its bounty, its gleaned treasure spread to all those in need. Friendship, the harvest of a life well spent.
In a scalding manner, I greet you, Cymon of Strath. And since I have no better, I will say it. The scaldic mead flows freely from Mimir's sounding, as you know. And from it you have craft so many times. times. Past the deepest valley to the highest mountain, in search of reason to fit your purest rhymes. As a proof of this, I now proceed to preach a little story, and thanks still met the scheme. How the bottom of the barrel one can reach to taste the sour dregs of that potent brew. I was with you 10 years ago in a gallery much like this. Your face seemed just as much aglow with all the wine and bliss. Watching you, oh, what a sight. Partaking in all that mirth and returning all that you drank that night back to Mother Earth. And even when consciousness escaped you, you still looked fine and fat. Drunk as a skunk, without a clue, I sent you home with a cat. Didn't I? What a Viking way to go. My horn, I raise so proud. Let the sweetmeats ever flow to my friend.
And let the love of our land sacred right to the love of our people succeed. And let friendship and honor unite and flourish on both sides between. No sweetness of senses can cheer when corruption and bribery bind, and no brightness the gloom can it clear when honors the sun of the mind. And let the love of our land sacred rights to the love of our people succeed, and let friendship and honor unite and flourish on both sides between. Let virtue distinguish the brave and place riches in the lowest degree. Take them poorest who can be a slave, and them richest who dared to be free. And let the love of our land sacred rights to the love of our people succeed, and let friendship and honor unite and flourish on both sides between. And let the love of our land sacred rights to the love of our people succeed, and let friendship and honor unite and flourish on both sides between.
Boris Johnson, our new Prime Minister. Almost as soon as I wrote those words, a vision of horror set into focus in my mind. This satanic book of the Conservative Party where in dripping blood and moaning cries, heroes Johnson's name fate to come after Miss May, as darkness follows darkness in a world we have warmed by the sun. The freakish biological winter of the Tory gene swamp gives Britain a distinctive gone-off odour. A bad old smell, they said, when Yellow Johnson sat on number 10 down the toilet street. Their children cried, and nobody could allay their tears, for Yellow Johnson had his hands all over the kingdom as if his dinner of chicken. The public were tidy things, squeaking away with industrious insignificance. Now the page turns on another chapter of diabolical thoughts. Yellow Johnson sniffs at the air of the nation. Fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell the blood of everyone. He rumbles, his belly gurgling the prospect of feeding off our succulent flesh. Austerity was not enough. Now the Conservatives are going to send Yellow Johnson to eat us all. Chomp our flesh, crunch our bones. Britain was ever the juicy larder for the insatiable Tory Morlocks. Our education, NHS, libraries, all designed to serve us on a plate and be eaten limb from limb by a white big Conservative minister. A sorry day to wake to. We could have made a system that did not turn us into dinners for the wealthy. Yellow Johnson, though, is coming with his blood-stained fork. I will not finish these words. The chapter turns, and the satanic book of the Conservative Party offers only the hammer of oblivion to relax on weekends after a week and the acts of deprivation.
Ziggy, il s'appelle Ziggy, je suis fort de lui, c'est un garçon pas comme les autres, mais moi je l'aime, c'est pas de fou, même si je sais qu'il ne m'aimera jamais. Ziggy, il s'appelle Ziggy, je suis fort de lui. La première fois que je l'ai vu, je me suis jeté sur lui dans la rue. Je lui ai seulement dit que j'avais envie de lui. Il était 4h du matin, j'étais seule et j'avais besoin de parler à quelqu'un. Il m'a dit, viens prendre un café et on s'est raconté nos vies. On a ri, on a pleuré, mais Ziggy, il s'appelle Ziggy, c'est mon seul ami. Dans sa tête, il n'y a que de la musique, il vend des disques dans une boutique. On dirait qu'il vit dans une autre galaxie. Tous les soirs, il m'emmène danser dans des endroits très très gais où il a des tas d'amis. Oui, je sais, il aime les garçons. Je devrais me faire une raison, essayer de l'oublier, mais Ziggy, il s'appelle Ziggy, je suis fort de lui. C'est un garçon pas comme les autres, mais moi je l'aime, c'est pas de ma faute, même si je sais qu'il ne m'aimera jamais.
harvest time in Gloucestershire travelling, in search of something chance will never bring. An old man's face, by life and weather cut, coloured, rough and sweet as any nut. A land face with sea blue eyes hung in my mind. After I left him miles behind, he disappeared in hawthorn, hazel, and old man's beard. 'Twas said he loved wild birds and beasts, had loved them from birth, one with another, as he loved the earth. He himself was wild and wandered. His home was where he was free. We have all met one such man as he. Does he clear old paths that no one uses, but once a lifetime as he loves or muses? He's as native as this celandine or yon briar. And when, aged 9, Lob Lie by the Fire came in my books, 'twas his face I saw. He's been here as long as dove and ball, calling the wild cherry tree the merry tree, Rose Campion, Bridget in her modesty. And in tender mood, as I guess, he christened one flower, Love in Idleness. From him, old Herbal Gerard learned as a boy to call the wild clematis the traveller's joy. Walking one spring from Exeter to Leeds, he named all cuckoo flowers milkmaids. He bestows many names, and he answers to many, if he answers at all, for he is Jack by the hedge, Jack of the greenstalk, beanstalk tall, Jack in the green. Ragged Robin, Robin Redbreast, Robin Goodfellow, Robin Hood, when seen. He is the watcher through the leaves, the joker in the ambush, the laughter in the empty clearing. She is the child you happen upon in a game of hide and seek. Aha! There you are! But she's not there next time. Like the chalk hill blue, the corncrake, and the cuckoo too. She was seen dying on land, in the air, at sea. Wherever there was harm to life, waste, profligacy. And yet she lives. She lives in you and in me, and in all who love wild birds and beasts, have loved them from birth, one with another, as we love the earth.
I am the pumpkin rich in seed, diving into the earth when the year is young. In her secret dark I see them grow, till her furrows burn green with my life begun.
Chorus. I am king of the corn, I am the corn king, I am the corn king, I am.
I am king of the corn, I am the corn king, I am the corn king, I am. Tossed by the wind and fed by the rain, I ripen and swell when the summer is high. Their acres wide I stand and turn, tall and gold beneath the sky.
Join in. I am king of the corn,
I am the corn king, I am the corn king, I am. I am king of the corn, I am the corn king, I am the corn king, I am. Once cockles and cornflowers bloomed among the crinkled poppies in their blood-red tide, but the grain still fattens and my stems grow long as I dream of the cutting at harvest tide.
I am king of the corn, I am the corn king,
I am the corn king, I am.
I am king of the corn,
I am the corn king, I am the corn king, I am.
fresh and batter me till I'm clean, so the miller may grind the flour from me.
I am king of the corn.
I am the corn king. I am the corn king. I am king of the corn. I am the corn king. I am the corn king. I am.
The baker, he kneads me up and then down, and leaves me to prove in the good brown bowl. Then into the oven until I'm done. I am bread in your basket and food for your soul.
I am king of the corn.
I am the corn king. I am the corn king. I am. I am king of the corn. I am the corn king. I am the corn king. I am.
My ears are as many as stars in the sky. I dance in the fields as the wind blows by. The stars and the earth cast glyphs and runes in my ripening grain, and you wonder why.
I am king of the corn.
I am the corn king. I am the corn king. I am. I am king of the corn. I am the corn king. I am the corn king. I am king of the corn. I am the corn king. I am the corn king. I am.
Yeah, sorry, it was a long way to get here. Coming from Glastonbury. These are just a couple of poems about exile. This is called Full Moon Over Westminster Abbey. Full moon over Westminster Abbey, and a teenager's walking like a pop star cockerel, is leading the chant, singing at the top of his voice, people got power, people, and people call back the refrain, power, power, like a chain gang breaking rocks. Girls sing, we have the power to change the world. We meet a lawyer from Manchester who was so committed to climate activism, she booked her holiday in the Easter holiday anyway, which coincides with the protest, and had to travel all the way back up to Manchester for one day's work, then travel back down again to resume protesting, and ended up as cook at Westminster. A pair of policemen walked through the camp, and she says, an Italian spilt the rice juice in the gutter, and they all got a bollocking. The live streaming came through of a girl who'd lost her size 7 shoes, and a new pair arrived at the camp within an hour, and a bottle of champagne. Drink it discreetly, she was told. This is not a drink zone. She lost her credit card organising buying food at Waitrose. A food bank operator from St Martin's asked me what the camp most needs this Easter. Water, I say, it's very hot. It's going to be so hot. A rickshaw driver offers us a free rickshaw ride along empty Whitehall at 2 o'clock in the morning past number 10. The police gun staring at us in our wooden tank of peace, waving a giant Extinction Rebellion flag to victory. This one is called, No, Helen, I don't want to be arrested. No, Helen, no, I don't want to be arrested. Oh, come on, it'll be fun. No, it won't be fun. We sit down in the middle of Oxford Circus. Whatever you do, says Helen 3 times, don't talk to a policeman. 5 minutes later, a policeman taps me on the shoulder. Can I have a word with you, sir? Yes, of course, I say, jumping up. A legal advisor in an orange luminous jerkin, ready, is taking notes. Can you move on, sir? I'll arrest you under Section 14. not talking. A policewoman sees me, looks at my age and says, go to Marble Arch. They've got toilets there, so. One girl has been cautioned for arrest a dozen times and just sits down somewhere else and hasn't been recognised. I stand plaintively the other side of the pink boat, like the dark side of the moon. I told you not to talk to a policeman, chafes Helen. I didn't, I say. If it happens again, just walk away. This is Dr. T. Deal. And he's going to tell you a story that's definitely not boring. It's a true story. And I was told it by the old man with the jewelry and the trench coat, and he was in his 90s. And he had done with something special. He had realized the dreams of hundreds of gardeners and created the Wrighton Organic Gardens Demonstration Centre. Has anyone been there? It's an amazing place. Anyway, the story goes like this. There was a man called Lawrence D. Hills, and he devoted his life to growing food and vegetables without the use of poisons. He understood that if you kill off all the bad things, what's left for the good things to eat? In nature, there is always a trade-off. A bargain is struck. He was the man that put little copper coils around the seedlings so the copper magnetic vibrations would keep away the slugs and snails. He synthesized the goodness of lime and wolf dung, mixed it with raw linseed oil, and painted it on the walls, especially at the exits and entrances, so to repel the cats and dogs, foxes and badgers. He cut out little squares and triangles and circles of yellow plastic, and he hung them around his garden, under the trees, in the glasshouse, anywhere where the hoverflies would see them and fly in and lay their eggs, and the little crocodile pupae would come out and eat the green flying platform. But the holy grail of keeping rabbits out of his cabbage patch had always eluded him. Until one night, and in the middle of it, he sat up in bed and said, I got it! Got what? Said his wife beside him. I've got the answer to the question. Question. What do rabbits fear most? Answer. Does anybody have an answer? What do rabbits fear most?
Other rabbits.
Mixing the toast. Well, his answer was the blood-curdling cry of a stoat. So in the morning, he downloaded the blood-curdling cry of a stoat, put it on a tape loop, and wired up his cabbage patch. That night, he sat in his armchair with his cup of Horlicks beside him here and a chocolate biscuit or two on the plate there, and he turned the master control to the half volume. The night was lit up with the high and screechy notes. A few dogs joined in barking. Maybe a cat or two yowled a bit. And he looked to his wife and said, mission cabbage. In the morning, when he investigated the cabbage patch, he discovered that all the cabbages around the edges had been eaten right down to their stumps. He said to his wife, I haven't been playing it loud. So the second night, he turned the master control 3/4 on, and the night was lit up with the high screechy notes. The cats and dogs in the neighborhood all joined in yowling and yapping, And the phone kept ringing.
Yes, yes, he told them, I know. But I'm doing this for all of us, don't you understand?
In the morning, when he investigated, he discovered that all of the cabbages had been eaten except the little block. He gritted his teeth and said nothing. But that night, he turned the master control onto the full volume, and the night was lit up with the high screechy notes. All the cats and the dogs joined in yapping and yowling. The starlings roosting in the wood lifted up and shrilled across the rooftops. The phone never stopped ringing. In the morning, when he went to investigate, he discovered that all of the cabbages had been eaten right down to their stumps. His wife tried to console him. Darling, she said, is it possible that what rabbits fear most is the deadly silence of the night, because that's when the stoats go a-hunting. Perhaps the blood-curdling cry is really the mating cry of the stoat. And everyone knows when a stoat is mating, it can only think of one thing at a time. And that, as every rabbit knows, is the very best time to go and eat cabbages. That is my story.
Where the river swings in channels wide, past Windsor walls in stately tide, where the bittern calls and the wild ducks glide, through rush and sedge and reed. Here lie the fields of high renown, where the Thames rolls by to London town, and wisdom springs in sacred ground, the fields of Runnymede. Oh, braided in like beads of green, here islands float with the tide between, with willows silver glistening, by rush and sedge and reed. And one of these a place I know, where those who seek deep silence go, and roots reach down to long ago, in the fields of Runnymede. There stands a tree, but more than tree, beneath the dusky canopy, the home of runes and mystery, by rush and sedge and reed. And those who would true counsel seek, from far and near their journey make, to the ancient yew of Anchorwick, in the fields of Runnymede. To the ground where grows this hallowed tree, many hundred years a sanctuary, may come no trace of treachery, by rush and sedge and reed. 'Tis a fitting place for the oath swearing, where the barons bold press John the King, to uphold the rights of all free men, in the fields of Runnymede. So the barons of all England came, with little trust but sure of aim, the powers of the king to tame, by rush and sedge and reed. There is higher law than royal will, to the charter drum must set his seal, and to earth new seed for freedom fell, in the fields of Runnymede. Though islands float in the Thames no more,
traffic roar, yet there remains a place of awe by rush and search and read. It is earth's healing now we seek. From the roots of wisdom let him speak. O sacred you of Angkawick, in the fields of Runnymede. It is earth's healing now we seek. From the roots of wisdom let him speak. O sacred you of Angkawick, in the fields of Runnymede.
The story is the subject of my first book, Quest for Unity. Now, the quest in question started when I went and joined a gathering on the mudflats of the Severn Estuary. And the purpose of the quest of the gathering was to do a medicine wheel for healing the African wheel, healing the African wound, which was the African wound of Bristol, which is the legacy left over from the slave trade, which rises and falls in unrest in Bristol City from time to time. So we were there to do this medicine wheel underneath the guidance of a Native American shaman. I want you to go and find 108 stones shaped like Africa, said the shaman. And I want you to find one special stone for yourself to mark the day. Well, I looked at the Severn Beach where we were and thought this is highly unlikely. If you've ever been there, the Severn Beach is a mud flat. And the only thing you find there is upturned shopping trolleys with missing wheels and sides caved in, bags and bottles, the odd half-buried seagull left over from the previous tide. Well, this is unlikely, finding stones here, and especially unlikely to find a special stone to mark the day for myself, but I was wrong. Within a few paces, I stopped, and I froze in horror, because there, sticking out of the mud at my feet, was what looked like a finger. Had I found a corpse? Relief chased the realization that no, this was a fluke of nature, a piece of stone shaped exactly like a digit with wrinkled knuckles and a well-defined fingernail. Oh, that's my special stone, I thought, and picked it up. And I was just about to put it in my pocket when into my mind dropped the word, no, follow the pointing finger, it'll lead you to your special stone. I looked down at the finger on my palm of my hand, and sod's law, the finger was pointing out across those mud flats to the distant turning tide. But I was so astonished by this, I set off across the mud flats. And before long, I was slipping and sliding in danger of losing not just my balance, but my shoes. This is crazy. Who ever heard of following a disembodied voice? So I turned to go back. No, came the voice again. Follow the pointing finger. So I turned back and carried on. This happened several times with me, losing courage and wanted to go back and being urged on again by follow the pointing finger until I was singing it out loud. Follow the pointing finger, follow the pointing finger, da 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 da, follow the pointing finger. And those stone gatherers close enough to hear me straightened up and looked at me and probably thought, crazy woman. Well, I ignored them and on I went until suddenly beside a strange shaped lump with some sedge grass growing out of it, the voice came again. stop, dig. And there I looked down at the ground at my feet, and there was this mound which seemed to promise something beneath it. So I started digging, scooping away the mud and flicking off these gobbets of smelly, stinking, sticky mud, and kept them going. And in my head I was seeing bushmen round their night skies, God knows why, but seeing bushmen round their night skies, their night time fires under the skies that changed and became bushmen, in Aboriginal bushmen out in the outback, round their night skies, and a man standing over them, leaning on his throwing stick. Oh, I'm going to Australia later on, I thought. Oh, this is going to be fun. And as I did that, my fingers struck something. And I worked my way around. Yes, it was able to be lifted clear. So I worked and pulled it out. It was covered with mud still. And I couldn't see its shape, but it was weighty. And it felt special. I looked around, there was a shallow pool left over from the previous tide. So I washed it off and stood up and looked at it. It was about 8 inches long. It was the most beautiful, perfect shape. A wonderful Neolithic ceremonial hand axe that was dated at being over 6,000 years old by the archaeological department at Bristol University. It was a shape so perfectly formed, it became in that instant my symbol of wholeness and unity. But it was more than that. It was as if the earth had given me a gift. It was a gift from the earth. And it was as if this was carrying a message which said there's a need for both the ancient world and the modern world to work together for the survival of both, bringing together the ancient wisdom of the indigenous people and the people of the modern technological world and all their expertise to work together. And as I was going off to Australia and I'd had those images in my mind, I thought this was going to take me there, and it was going to take me in search of a place and the people who lived there who were living with the old wisdoms that I could learn from. But that and all the adventures that I met along the way is not for now. That is the subject of my book.
There were three brothers, the eldest brother and the middle brother. They were both strong and skillful hunters. Whenever they took aim with their bows and arrows, they never missed their target. But the youngest brother, he was weak and sickly, and his skin was covered with sores. And whenever he tried to shoot anything with his bow, he always missed. And so his grandma had to look after him. And then one time, there came into that part of the forest two giant howler monkeys that roared around the forest, howling the tops of their voices, chasing and terrifying everybody. And the eldest brother and the middle brother said, "Well, we, being such strong and skillful hunters, will go and deal with these miscreant howler monkeys." And off they went. On their way, as they followed the sound of the howling through the trees, they came upon an ugly toad woman. And the toad woman said to the two brothers,
I will help you defeat the howler monkey if one of you promises to marry me."
And the eldest brother said, "We couldn't possibly marry such an ugly creature as you." And the second brother said, "Well, besides, we are such strong and skillful hunters, we never miss our target. We have no need of your help." And they continued on their way towards the howling. And they took their position. And the two giant howler monkeys, they were huge. And they came leaping from branch to branch through the trees, gripping in their hands, throwing axes, which is unusual behavior for howler monkeys. And they came so fast, uttering such a voluminous howling, The two brothers, strong and skillful though they were so terrified they could hardly hold their bows and arrows. They just dropped them to the ground, and they turned tail, and they ran, and they ran, and they ran right out of that forest. And they were never seen there again. Meanwhile, in another part of the forest, the youngest brother was trying to hunt birds. And he took aim at a particular bird with his bow and missed, as usual, and he went to hunt for the arrow in the undergrowth. And as he did so, he heard from low to the ground a voice saying, "Can I help you?" And he looked and he saw, peeping out of a hole in the ground, it was the face of a snake. And with a coil of his tail, the snake lifted up out of the hole an arrow. "Is this yours?" said the snake. "It dropped into my home." "I'm so sorry," said the youngest brother, and he lifted the arrow out of the hole. And, well, this hunting business, it was so difficult. And the snake seemed quite friendly. So he sat down beside the snake, and they had a talk. And the snake looked at the sores on the youngest brother's skin and said, "Oh, those sores look very painful. What medicine are you using?" And the youngest brother, he shrugged and said, "No one can cure me. I'm useless. I'm no good for anything. I always miss when I try to shoot anything, and my grandma has to look after me." And the snake said, "Well, it's good you found me. I have some ointment that can help you." And so the youngest brother, he stayed for 7 days with that snake. And every day, the snake, with a smooth, sinuous movement of its body, applied the ointment to the skin of the youngest brother. And after 7 days, all the sores were gone, and his skin was smooth as a child's, and he looked great. But then he heard, through the trees, the sound of a howling noise, howler monkeys. And he said to the snake, "Oh, I thank you, but I must be on my way, because my brothers went to hunt these giant howler monkeys, and I can hear they're still there, and there's no sign that my brothers have come back." And the snake said to the youngest brother, "Oh, those are not real howler monkeys. They're demons disguised as howler monkeys. That's why they're behaving in this strange way. Your brothers will never be able to defeat them. But you could with this." And with a twist of his tail, the snake pulled up out of his hole a long magic arrow. "Oh, thank you," said the youngest brother. "But it's only one arrow. There are two howler monkeys." "Fear not," said the snake. "On your way to find the howler monkeys, you'll come upon an ugly toad woman, and she will ask you to marry her. And so you must promise to marry her, and then she will show you what to do." "But marry an ugly toad woman? Don't worry about that," said the snake. "It might not be as bad as it sounds." And so off he went with the long magic arrow and his bow, following the sound of the howling of the howler monkeys, and sure enough, he came upon the ugly toad woman. So he promised to marry her. And she came with him toward the sound of the howler monkeys. And she told him what to do. She showed him a place in the bushes where he could, would be a good spot to ambush them. And then they waited, and they came. And they were huge, and they were making such a noise, and they came so fast, leaping through the branches with their throwing sticks. But the toad woman was there right beside the youngest brother. And she helped him to hold the bow, and she helped him to aim the arrow. And then she called out, "Now, and let fly the arrow." And it pierced through the two howler monkeys at the same time. And they both exploded, and in puffs of smoke, the demons within them swirled up into the sky. And the two empty howler monkey skins landed with a flump on the forest floor, still pierced by the magic arrow. So he retrieved the arrow and the two skins, and followed by the toad woman, he made his way back to the snake and gave the snake the two skins as a thank you present. And in return, estate gave him a whole armful of the magic arrows. Now you never need fear losing an arrow again. And so with the arrows under his arm and the bow and with the toad woman following along behind, he made his way home to his grandma's house. And just now he was starting to get worried about having to marry the toad woman. And especially what his grandma might say. But when they got back to the grandma's house, the moment that the toad woman stepped across the threshold of the grandmother's house, she was transformed into a beautiful woman. And the grandma thought she was great. And the youngest brother, he loved her. And they got married, and they had children. And the youngest brother, with his magic arrows and his smooth skin, he became a great hunting man. Whenever he aimed his bow, he never missed his target. And with his skill, he was able to provide for his family, for his grandma and his children, and his beautiful wife.
On the morning of the balcony, smell of honeysuckle in the air, and the birds they were singing, and the sun's rays on the air, and I strolled out on the hillside, and I'd done many times before, but never had I noticed just what the fuss was for. She's my Harley Quinn, I'm her Jack in the green. She's the one I love, and I know she loves me. She's my Harley Quinn, my bride to be. As she strolls riding on ice, a crown of flowers in her hair, wearing a dress of green and white. Now her smile was so inviting, her eyes as warm as the sun. She took my hand in hers, and it fit like love. She's my Harley Quinn, I'm her Jack in green. She's the one I love, and I know she loves me. She's my Harley Quinn, she's my bride. With strength, courage, and valor, over the broomstick we've jumped. Our hands bound together, the union has just begun. She's my May Queen, I'm her Jack in the green. She's the one I love, and I know she loves me. She's my May Queen, my bride.
Anyway, Pimplov was a member.
enjoyment to improve his social skills, his counter fingers sounding, but that only led to the blood and the thrill. The killing was never demanding. He'd found himself a party job, a junior exterminator who toured the town just keeping down the rodent population. Pounce and kill with a twist that was still an ongoing education. With the warm fur, fill the pressure and snap the solution to the equation. Then Pimplov sees his first human body. One day, on his way to working, missed by the clearing teams, a vagrant lost one, vermin. Pickaxe to the head and veil of red, but blotted by the blackness of the pain. That was how he'd imagined it. A clean blow, the flattened skull, the matted blood and hair, but why no broken arms and legs? And why no facial bruising? Too clean. Too clean. He imbibed every detail, and yet the blood, brains on the pavement, in that there was something. And he thought, as he went with his cart and back bent, he thought them too professional. For to be an actant in the good of the state was the equal division of pleasure. Of course, the uniform, belt and tool, the badge that declared one a leader, but to pounce on and kill with a consummate skill, none of the determined danger, that was the ecstasy. A social ill, the lost one. We bring them back as they went out. To err is to say goodbye and then to greet the curfew. Each fresh day's crop of failures, a new quarry tangling into the night to find a light of darkness. Of course, he'd had those dreams. He'd had to learn again each day after the catechisms of acceptance. New doors opened, old avenues closed. Could taste that blood, tongue, grit and wet clothing, redemption, that for all, no wonder he'd joined. Someone turns the corner, Pimplov moves on, the day of work and the memory stayed, and the rats tumble out of the dust cart, lay stiff and silent, but Pimplov is blooded. All hail the master of destruction. Let true disorder rule the law of landed gentry. Leave the land of milk and plenty for the reward. The enforcement of peace or death, which is much more likely. The pressure rises, the date grows nearer. Always the grass grows longer. Pleasure in the dreaming stomp and blood and hit and crack. The cold methodology screaming. The struggle goes on. With a fireball, with a disregard for the owner, street control, rock and roll, dull reimbursement, we're on. See, sweep the streets with certainty, resettlement of offenders. They settle the hash of the welfare class, bring on murder, an activist bomber. When there's blood on the tracks of community tax, and the car seats of those who dissented, we've forgotten the cause of innumerable wars when the phrase save Britain was empty. Save and recycle. Save and turn around. Save, but eat plenty. Be saved, but be found not wanting. And don't say offended.
This is called Jackie Henry.
And if you return to whispering,
Jack in the green, a dancing with his queen. And from the rocky cliffs of Cornwall, beyond Shadale and Lakeland fell, to the highlands of Scotland they will tell. A tale about the ferryman at the ferry fair. I do believe the green man was there. And I see Jack in the green, behind his beard leaves. I see Jack in the green, a dancing with his queen.
Thank you, Simon, and I think Mark had a whistle there as well.
Yeah.
Shut up.